In 2004, I first found out about the ancient and mysterious structure under Rockwall, Texas, known as the Rockwall. Since I had spent a lot of my early life in the outlying areas around Rockwall, I became immediately interested in uncovering this phenomenon. In 2011, I set out to make the film about the Rockwall, but along the way, I started to discover other structures and other things around the United States that played into the research that I was doing into the Rockwall. This film became the Lost Secrets of Ancient America series, of which there are now 3 films. Here and now, for the first time, in a standalone film, is all the Rockwall information I have gathered to date, including some newly gathered footage taken of a section of the wall at the University of Texas in Arlington.
In 2004, while reading the book Rule My Secrecy, I came across mention of an ancient and possibly man-made wall buried some 7 stories below the town of Rockwall, Texas. Immediately, I became very interested in the subject due to the fact that I've lived in the same area in North Texas where Rockwall is located my entire life, and had often heard stories of strange sightings and bizarre phenomena in the area. After finding what little information I could about the Rockwall, in 2008, I met John Lindsay, an architect and amateur archaeologist who had conducted his own independent excavation on a section of the wall in the late 1990s, but when his funding dried up, the dig was shut down before it was completed. Lindsay gained an interest in the wall from looking at Landsat images from NASA when he worked for them on Apollo 12. He has done extensive analysis and study of the wall and believes it to be a man-made creation. As I began to compile the best available evidence for the wall's unnatural origins, I set out to determine who could have built it and what other places or artifacts similar to what is found at Rockwall exist in North America and even the world. The answers to these questions may shock you as much as they have me, and we will detail these further in the series.
The city of Rockwall, Texas is a suburb of Dallas and sits not only on the wall itself, but also on the smallest and one of the wealthiest counties in the state. The National Road of the Republic of Texas, or the Military Road as it was called, was surveyed and constructed in the mid-1840s, and it ran through the area that would later become Rockwall County, running northeast from the Red River to near the site of present-day Dallas. The cities of Rockwall and Heath were founded along this road. The state of Texas was admitted into the United States of America on December 29, 1845. In 1846, the area of Rockwall County was included in Henderson County, and when Kaufman County was formed in February 1848, the region became part of that county. Sterling Rex Barnes was the first person to settle in Rockwall County in 1846, according to Mercer Colony documents. His land was situated between the East Fork and the Military Road. He constructed a ferry on the East Fork of the Trinity River in 1848 and obtained a permit from the state of Texas to build a bridge across the river. Barnes was followed by other Mercer colonists, including Ephraim and John Oswell Heath in 1846, who built their cabin near the site of Barnes Bridge and called their community Black Hill, named for the infamous black, waxy soil of the area. In 1848, Benjamin F. Boydston, Terry U. Wade, and Jared Stevens arrived and all brought their families to the region to establish a farming community. Stevens, Boydston, and Wade were hoping to establish a trading post on the eastern shore of the East Fork of the Trinity River. Although friends, the three men were at odds among themselves, each declaring to be the first settler at the site and deserving to have the future town named for themselves. In 1849, James Truett settled 2 miles north of Rockwall and established a community called Locust Grove. And after living in a makeshift cabin for a few years, in 1851, Terry Utley Wade and his family began building a permanent house on the east side of the East Fork of the Trinity River Valley near the western edge of the present site of the Rockwall Square. In the process of digging the homestead water well, Mr. Wade hit a stone formation. Further digging and investigation discovered a rock wall below the surface. The wall ran an extended length across Wade's property and that of his neighbors. Barnes and Heath, the first two settlers, were both Freemasons and recognized the building style as the work of stonemasons, and their immediate reaction upon seeing the wall was that it was a remnant of a lost civilization. Thus, this was where the idea first had its genesis. They decided that that fact meant that none of them were actually the first settler of the area, and instead of naming their new settlement after themselves, they named it for the Rock Wall, resolving their differences. On April 17, 1854, Elijah Elgin donated 40 acres of his land to establish a town at the site, centrally located in the panhandle of Kaufman County. This community became known as Rockwall. The following is information gathered from Mary Patty Gibson, granddaughter of T.U. Wade. She described the additional digging her grandfather and other men did at the home site. In this description were cubicles or rooms constructed of stone which you could walk through and would reach a quarter which seemed to run in a direction into the hill that the town square sits above. She told of an incident in 1906 of two unidentified men digging out the quarter which had apparently been filled with erosion. Their intent was to reach a room or cavity under the town which would be full of gold, apparently derived in part from Indian legend. The ceiling of the corridor had steep slopes, described as a Gothic-type arched ceiling, much like what the Mayans built, and the further into the corridor the two men excavated, the steeper the slope of the ceiling became. Consequently, the men, fearful of a structural failure, abandoned their search for gold. The Rockwall Courthouse was erected on this site in 1941. She also spoke of her grandfather's exploration of the wall and that he discovered on the outside that the wall went straight down. But on the inside, she described the wall as going down to about 40 feet, curving inward and becoming much thicker. This sounded like a buttress effect that has been used to support high-standing structures and implies direction and transfer of live loads. Additional information provided by the daughter of the late Mr. DeWeese, an early settler of Rockwall, described a doorway with a diagonal-shaped stone in the wall at the Wade residence on Highway 66. This portion of the wall was open to visitors from 1936 until the late 1940s and was consequently backfilled, supposedly, because of dangerous structural conditions. In 1901, Dr. Robert T. Hill, a Texas geologist, published an article about the rock wall and classified them as clastic sand dikes and a part of the Balcones Fault System. In 1909, Sidney Page published an article in Science Magazine entitled The Rock Wall of Rockwall, Texas. He stated, quote, "The writer was able during the past winter to spend a few days investigating this supposed historic structure. It proves to be not a wall, but a number of disconnected sandstone dikes, strictly speaking, not surrounding the town, but trending in many directions." In 1925, world-famous archaeologist Count Byron de Prorok was brought to Rockwall to examine the structure. De Prorok stated that he had only seen stones like these one other place in the world, in Carthage in North Africa, an ancient Phoenician Canaanite city. De Prorok was loved by audiences and held in contempt by the scientific community for his daring adventure stories and his challenging of accepted scientific dogma. In 1927, hot on the heels of De Prorok's comments on the rock wall, the Smithsonian Institute sent two scientists to examine the wall by the names of L.W. Stevenson and J.W. Fuchs. Stevenson and Fuchs deemed it to be a natural formation, and their verdict, made in 1927, mind you, stands to this day in the realms of scientific opinion. In 1933, a map was prepared by Martin Kelsey and Harold Denton with the aid of J.S. Mason, Rockwall County surveyor, of all the discovered outcroppings thought to be the wall at that time. There were 11 known outcroppings, and these so-called outcroppings were believed at the time to be above-ground visible parts of the wall and were the sites that the aforementioned scientists based their opinion of the wall being natural on. And right here is where we start to see holes in those opinions. When we enter the latitude and longitude of these so-called outcroppings into Google Earth and overlay John Lindsay's map, we can clearly see that these outcroppings do not occur on the actual wall itself, but fall inside the perimeter of the wall structure. This leads us to the conclusion that we are dealing with two different types of phenomenon here. Either by accident or by design, the two are being jumbled together, creating confusion as to what is really the wall and what isn't. Since, according to official records, we know that there were not any major excavations done at the rock wall until 1936, when it was put on display to the public at the site of the old Wade Farm, and we've established that the wall is buried deep underground, then the opinion that these scientists from the Smithsonian and other institutions established is obviously being based on flawed data. This is why I believe there is so much confusion on the part of interested parties who believe they can just come to Rockwall and see the wall. We have a set-in-stone scientific opinion on the wall that was established in 1927, an opinion that was not given from an observance of an archaeological excavation, but from these so-called outcroppings outlined in the 1933 survey. And these may or may not be the actual wall itself. And this opinion has gone unchallenged by the mainstream of science and academia ever since, despite the huge advancements in technology that could prove otherwise. This is one of the major goals of this film series. I hope to force a new examination of the rock wall phenomenon based on the research data and new understandings we now have attained since 1927. In 1936, coinciding with the Texas State Centennial, a section of the wall is excavated and opened for viewers for a small admittance fee. The attraction is owned by R.F. Canup. In the first few months, the attraction averaged 70 visitors per day. In the late 1940s, a state geologist pressured the Texas Historical Commission to close Mr. Canup's 10 cents a look exhibit on Highway 66 because Mr. Canup advertised the section of the wall as a part of a prehistoric buried city. The geologist maintained that this was a fraud being foisted on the public. Mr. Canup later cited structural instability as the reason for closing and backfilling the site, but we know this was not the actual reason. In 1949, a Mr. Sanders of Fort Worth conducts an excavation on property near what is now FM 549 and Cornelius Road. The rocks in this excavation average 12 to 14 inches thick. Interestingly, no one has ever been able to track down any trace of Mr. Sanders, but we do have these photos of his excavation. In 1950, Dr. James L. Glenn, a local doctor who was fascinated with the wall and discovered this artifact in a ravine near the wall, believed it to be a representation of the Mayan god Quetzalcoatl. Published in an essay, Photographic Essay on the System of Rock Walls at Rockwall, Texas, among his observations, Glenn states, quote, "The fact that there is a natural fault here does not preclude the construction of other walls by a prehistoric race within the same region." Here, he is implying two different types of phenomena. In 1959, Dr. John T. Lonsdale denounces Dr. Hill from the University of Texas's claim from 1901 by asserting that the Balcones Fault has not been traced with any significance beyond the Hill County, and that no known fault system runs through Rockwall County. In 1976, the Rockwall is excavated under the direction of the county on land located near present-day FM 549 in Cornelius Road, the same site where Mr. Sanders had excavated in 1949. The excavation is open to the public, and hundreds of schoolchildren visit the wall. Also, in 1976, to commemorate the Texas sesquicentennial, this makeshift model of the wall was constructed in front of the Rockwall Courthouse, where it sits to this day. It is comprised of stones taken from the 76 dig. In 1979, Dr. Kenneth Shaw of the University of Texas at Arlington and his students exposed two walls for study. Shar concluded that both of the sections he examined were natural formations, but does not rule out the possibility that another portion could be man-made. No further excavations were presumably done until John Lindsay's dig in the late 1990s. It becomes abundantly clear when one examines the physical evidence that what we are dealing with in Rockwall is two distinctly different types of phenomenon that are being lumped together as the same thing in order to keep any real headway from being made in terms of an honest investigation. In an April 1880 edition of the Dallas Daily Times Herald, an article appeared describing strange triangular-shaped plates with Phoenician lettering, skull and crossbones, an all-seeing eye, and reports that they rang like a bell when struck and were said to have been found in a strata where dinosaur bones were being extracted. The following is the article as it appeared. Mysterious relics, more specimens found near Browder Springs. Does the light of other days shine on us through them? It is a fact well known in this city that in the many excavations, diggings, and borings that have been made by the water supply company and others around Browder Springs in Dallas, numerous geological and zoological specimens have been found. The teeth and different bones of mastodons on different occasions have been dug up in fossilized shells, and not a great while ago, at a considerable distance under the surface, Mr. Duncan, City of Dallas engineer, while getting out gravel near these springs, found a number of eggs of either some member of the saurian species or of some large fowl, the shells in a perfect state of preservation. The waters of these springs, being strongly impregnated with lime, seem to have a tendency to petrify animal and vegetable matter. These specimens that have been found go to show that this country, in ages past, was the home of the mastodon and other orders of the animal kingdom long since extinct. We find, too, in various parts of the Union, traces of the existence of peoples who lived centuries ago and who have left behind them no mark to tell who or what they were, save these traces as shown in pottery, in hieroglyphics, and in the bits of skeletons of themselves found in the mounds, many of which have become noted and which much has been written both in prose and in poetry. Colonel L.J. Dupree, former editor of the Austin Statesman, but now in Washington, has investigated the subject of the mound builders and written a number of papers for Harper's Monthly and other magazines about them. And he has also poeticized on the subject. In some parts of the country, too, walls and the ruins of seeming fortifications have been found. erected by hands that centuries ago crumbled into dust. The hands of a people far more intelligent and advanced in civilization than any of the Indian races found in America. All these things lead the cultivated and informed people of the country to believe that this country in the long ago was inhabited by a race or races of people who had advanced as far in the arts and sciences as obtained in the days of Hiram, when Solomon was building the temple at Jerusalem, and when the mighty tomes were being gathered into the great library at Alexandria. Yesterday, while some excavations were being made at Browder Springs at the depth of some 20 feet below the surface, three tablets of a peculiar nature were discovered. They were rough and encrusted with dirt when first dug up, but their triangle shape and a ringing sound they emitted when struck with a pickaxe arrested the attention of the workmen, and they stopped to examine them. The dirt was scraped off of them, and they were washed clean. They seemed to be of petrified wood, but were perfect, no part having decayed on one of them, with the other two being somewhat defaced. As we said, they were triangle in form, being isosceles triangles, the sides of one being 6 inches in length, and the other two 4 inches. A description of the large one is an accurate description of all of them, and we give it here. Near the apex is a letter, and immediately underneath it the figure of a human eye. On each side of which is a letter, and underneath the eye, another letter. Underneath this last letter is a skull and crossbones, on either side of which is another letter. The two smaller tablets have evidently the same symbols on them, though they are defaced apparently by the decay of the wood. The human eye and the skull and crossbones are the work of a master hand. No wood engraver of this day and time could make better. The letters are old Phoenician characters. The tablets were brought to the Herald office in Dallas, and to decipher the hieroglyphics was the work of the hour. Research soon revealed the fact that they were Phoenician characters and corresponding with our letters A-D-M-O-S-L. Below, we give an exact diagram of the tablet, substituting English letters to correspond with the Phoenician letters. The query, naturally, is how did those tablets come to be buried near Browder Springs? That they had lain in the earth there for centuries, there can be no question. The earth above them was the gradual, slow formations of long, long years. Dynasties and empires passed away, and generation after generation was called to their final account during the years they have lain there. Ethnologically, the Phoenicians were Arabs, or connected with the Arabian family. Nomadic in nature, they were disposed to roam over the face of the world, and we can readily believe that they found their way to America wandering through the wilds of Asia, the snows of Siberia, and across the Bering Strait, either in boats improvised for the purpose or perhaps upon the ice. They were dark in color as our Indians are, and it may be that the American Indians are descended from this people as well. The Phoenicians, we know, made the first alphabet and originated mathematics. We too know that they were skillful workers in gold and silver, iron and brass, and that the products of their looms were prized over the then known world. They were proficient in letters, arts, and sciences. Hiram, king of Phoenicia, sent to Solomon, when he was building the temple, an artist skilled to work in gold and silver and stone and timber, and who could grave any manner of graving. They had a religion of their own, and wherever they wandered, they clung to the traditions, legends, and ceremonies of their country. Is it impossible that these three little triangular tablets, with their Phoenician letters to speak for them, are not relics that speak to us from the grave of buried centuries? To tell us that once, where we now live and boast our intelligence and civilization, a people lived equally as intelligent and learned in handicraft as we. This is but speculation, it is true, but the tablets are here and can be seen by anyone at the office of the Water Supply Company on Austin Street in Dallas. With all that we have learned so far, are we to believe that this is just another joke, as has been suggested that the Rockwall Giant reports are? Are we to believe that people in the late 1800s just made up stuff about the Dallas area willy-nilly? These, of course, disappeared, but what is interesting is that they were found near the site of where the Dallas Masonic Cathedral would be built a few years later in the early 1900s. The outside of the cathedral looks as if it were built on a mound and has an underground basement level that seems to be built into the mound itself. This is very strange because we do not have basements in this part of the country due to the soil composition. This is also about a block away from Dealey Plaza. Now that I had evidence of sophisticated builders with advanced knowledge inhabiting the Americas in ancient times, my next task was to examine further the construction and materials contained in the rock wall and the origins of the stone's materials. If the wall had builders, builders need materials, and those materials had to come from somewhere, and I set out to find just where that could be. Based on data obtained from previous archaeological studies conducted on the rock wall between the 1940s and late 1990s, Here's what we know for sure about the rock wall's makeup. The cast stones that comprise the rock wall are made of 55% zircon, 17% garnet, 13% tourmaline, 2% rutil, 2% starlight, 10% titanite, and 1% brookite. It also contains niobium, which we use today in modern metal alloys. The stones are jointed with a geopolymer mortar substance perfectly buttered as if with a trowel. This mortar substance contains three different types of quartz blended specifically to grow and expand on the stones. The entire structure has a mean elevation of 550 feet above sea level, meaning that it was leveled by someone. The entire structure encompasses a 20-mile diameter area that extends from Rockwall County and into neighboring counties. These minerals do not exist anywhere else in this area of Texas, so their existence here is an anomaly any way you slice it. Even stranger is the fact that the molecular structure of these minerals remain independent in situ in the stone. This should be impossible, and geologists have no explanation for this occurrence. In fact, one geologist has stated that these minerals would be impossible to combine in Earth's current atmosphere. Since there are no stone quarries anywhere near Rockwall, or really any stone at all for that matter, I began to search for a location where these specific minerals could be quarried in sufficient enough quantities to mix, cast, and build the Rockwall stones.
With one of the Hanby stones, which are just several stones I found out where I was living that were taken from the wall in from Mr. Hanby, who came from Virginia. He was a mason, real big in masonry, and he collected these stones, which are triangular, and they have inscriptions on them, and he used them as foundations, as they used to in rock wall houses, and steps. But when he situated them, he put with engraved inscriptions all down into the clay, face down, so it would protect them. So, in where I lived out there at the time, we happened to come across these and got them up, and sure enough, I recognized inscriptions on it. Well, not only did I recognize inscriptions, but we found matching inscriptions on stones coming out of Egypt and from the Temple of Khnum in Anzwa. So now I'm beginning to get triangulation of the inscriptions. And with triangulation is how you get decipherment. We're working on that. The dating of this coin and the freshness of the chandeliers and the apparent cover-up of the wall, then I have to date with what I'm looking at can bring it down into 20 to 200,000 years of ago this wall was exposed because of where the inscriptions and their timetables and matches are leading me. So that's how I arrive at that supposition at this point in time, which is really a very narrow timeline. Hey, let's talk about the composition. I keep referring to, we refer to the wall as the rock wall. Actually, the composition, and this was determined back in the 40s and 50s. It was tested again, and it's been tested by me again. And the composition is made up of extremely heavy minerals. They're all crystals and precious stones. Now, I'm going to list them for you here. You get on the website and see its density, specific gravity, and its percentage there, and get the weight. That's where our weight and hardness comes from, is these crystals. And it's 55% made up of zircon. 17% of it is garnet. 13% of it is tourmaline. 2% is rutil. 2% is starlight. 10% is titanite. And 1% is brookite. And that is the composition of the stone, which totally is composed of all crystals and precious stones. It's a metamorphic crystalline structure. Okay, so the composition is as I've listed. Because it is all crystal, we found out, I won't go into the details, it's an electronic and its acoustic properties of the wall is piezoelectric. In other words, when you get a vibration going on that wall, it roars at you and it puts out electrical currents that will light up light bulbs or anything else. We found that it's piezoelectric, and we found this by a tractor and its tracks running about 2 feet above the wall without touching it, and the vibrations of the motor tuning into the frequency of the crystal, much like back in Boy Scouts or young kids, crystal radios, same deal. And setting it off, well, it began to roar at us, even hurting on the tractor. And I didn't know what was going on. The whole ground was roaring as far as we could hear, and it got deeper and bigger. Well, what astounded me is through the sound, I had a visualization of the enormity of this wall. That's what kept striking me about it. And then through and further investigation with the geologists, found out, oh, it's piezoelectric. It would do that, okay? Now, going back to other attributes of the stone, its hardness, it's a very hard stone in the wall. By the way, the stone in the rock wall is the only rock that's in rock wall. There is no other in the rivers, in the creeks, other than what's been brought into rock wall. There is no other stone that's ever been found in Rockwall County that hasn't been brought in. So it's foreign to the nature of this geological column to even have stone present. But the stone is very hard, and we measured it on the Mohr scale. It's an 8, a diamond being 10. So it took me with a 20-pound sledgehammer, I think Bud Shelton denotes in his paper, to even crack the stone because he tried. So it's a very, very hard stone. The stone density is 40.08 grams per cubic centimeter. It's very heavy. It's heavier than granite or marble or any other things we know. It weighs, I've had it tested, it's over 200 pounds a cubic foot, where marble and granite is 175 pounds a cubic, just give you a relationship. So it's a very heavy stone, and it gets its heaviness primarily from the zircon that's in it, zircon and garnet. Those are the two heaviest materials and where it gets its weight. The stone wall is very magnetic in the nature of it, and that has to do with its crystalline value. Now, the earth, the magnetism in the earth is measured in Gausses, G-A-U-S-S-E-S.
Right.
And the earth has naturally 5/10 of a gauss, or half a gauss, okay? This wall, we put the instruments on it, and it measures up to 40 gausses, real high magnetic output. And the reason we did this, because they started, surveyors and all, started bringing their computerized instruments out there, and they'd get them near the wall, they'd spin and burn up. It's because of that high magnetism, just why, the reason you can't. So that was a very unique possibility. So we got a very hard stone. It's primary crystal. It's really high in its magnetic values. It's very hard. It's piezoelectric and is metamorphous crystalline structure. So that makes it very unique. So that's the composition.
As I began my search for Rockwall's quarry, I considered what criteria this location would have to meet in order to be the most likely spot for their origins. It would have to be somewhere very geologically active with an abundance of minerals and rare earth metals, specifically of the types found in Rockwall. While researching where these have been found in Texas, I discovered mention of a place called Barringer Hill. Barringer Hill is a geological and mineralogical site in central Texas. It lies on the former west side of the Colorado River beneath Lake Buchanan, about 22 miles northeast of the town of Llano. The hill consists of a pegmatite and geologically lies near the eastern edge of the central mineral region in the Texas Hill Country. It is named for John Barringer, who discovered it in large amounts of gadolinite in about 1887. Described by the United States Geological Survey as one of the greatest deposits of rare earth minerals in the world, the pegmatite was the first place geologists discovered fergusonite, monofergusonite, thorogummite, yttrolite, and ninvanite. Of the 47 minerals discovered at Barringer Hill, gadolinite, a radioactive form of yttria, triggered the most interest at the time. This greenish-black ore had previously only been found in small quantities in Russia and in Norway. Because of its economic potential as a material for light filaments, both Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse attempted to obtain the hill. In 1903, German chemist Walther Nernst, who later became famous for discovering the third law of thermodynamics, was working for Westinghouse when he developed a street light that used raw gadolinite as a filament. The mineral species rich in yttrium erbium were more particularly sought after because thorium and uranium were not used in the glower. The Nernst Lamp Company, a subsidy of Westinghouse, then bought Barringer Hill and began mining and extracting a few hundred pounds of yttrium minerals annually for a few years. Eventually, Nernst Lamp Company ceased operations as newer technology surpassed the lamp. The 73-pound group of crystals found in March 1903 was the greatest find of record in this mineral. But just 1 year later, a mass of roughly crystallized gadolinite was found. partly embedded in the bedrock at the northeast corner of the hill. It measured 36 inches long, 11 inches thick at the widest part, and weighed a little over 200 pounds. When Beringer Hill was first discovered, there was evidence of some unknown quarrying operation that had gone on there sometime in the distant past. This was written off with the story that tourists had carried out hundreds of thousands of cubic yards of material before any commercial mining had been done there. Lake Buchanan was formed by the construction of Buchanan Dam by the Lower Colorado River Authority to provide a water supply for the region and to provide hydroelectric power. Buchanan Dam, a structure over 2 miles in length, was completed in 1939. Lake Buchanan was the first of the Texas Highland Lakes to be formed, and with 22,333 acres of surface water, it is also the largest. The surface of the lake includes area in both Burnett County and Llano County. The lake is west of the city of Burnett, Texas. In 1934, the Texas legislature authorized the formation of the Lower Colorado River Authority to complete the Hamilton Dam. Following completion in 1937, the dam was renamed for U.S. Representative James P. Buchanan, who was involved in obtaining federal funding for the project from the Public Works Administration. Construction of the dam required the relocation of the town of Bluffton, Texas. Relocation began in 1931 and was complete by 1939. Beringer Hill was one of the first locations to be covered by the lake and dam, leading many to believe that someone was trying to hide it out of sight and out of mind. I heard rumors of uranium being mined from a cavern at Beringer Hill, which was never sealed due to the lake filling up with water way ahead of schedule. Just like Rockwall and Muscle Shoals, once again we have important evidence buried under a man-made lake in the name of progress. And with Edison and Westinghouse's involvement, knowing about their stealing and selling of Nikola Tesla's technology to J.P. Morgan, my interest was definitely piqued. It was time to hit the road again to check out Beringer Hill to see if I could determine if this was the site where the rock wall materials originated. Lake Buchanan is located 60 miles northwest of Austin and about 215 miles south of Dallas. An ongoing drought in the area has supposedly caused some of the sites usually covered by the lake to be exposed. So I wanted to see if we could catch a glimpse of Beringer Hill before it disappeared back under the lake near the dam. As luck would have it, almost as if they were expecting me, the area was bombarded with chemtrails the day we arrived. And then the day we had set out to shoot also happened to be the day that this years-long drought magically broke. Even though I was unable to get footage that day, I still wanted to visit the Buchanan Dam to see if Beringer Hill was exposed or not. After driving around for a while with no luck finding the dam entrance, a lady at the visitor center informed me that you could no longer access or tour the dam as it was shut down and taken over by the Department of Homeland Security in 2008. 2008 is also when the drought began, so I started to understand why there had been so many chemtrails in the area. The mining of rare earth metals in the United States is strictly regulated by the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. China currently has the global stranglehold on rare earth metals and is increasing their price every day as their stockpiles dwindle. If you aren't sure why this would affect you, think about this. Your TV, your car, your smartphone, laptop, satellites, and defense systems all do not work without the use of rare earth metals. Texas Governor Rick Perry allowed the Chinese Huawei Corporation to set up their world headquarters in Plano, Texas, despite the fact that Homeland Security has deemed the Huawei Corporation as a significant threat to national security because of their cyber espionage activities. The Huawei Corporation is the single biggest consumer of rare earth metals in the world, and as the U.S. Geological Survey put it, few, if any, deposits in the world, and certainly no others in America outside of the localities where monazite is found, have yielded such quantities of rare earth metals as that at Beringer Hill. Go to a search engine and type the words weather modification China, and you will find that China leads the world in weather modification technology. The Beijing Weather Modification Office is a unit of the Beijing Meteorological Bureau tasked with weather control in Beijing and its surrounding areas, including parts of Hebei and Inner Mongolia. The Beijing Weather Modification Office forms a part of China's nationwide weather control effort believed to be the world's largest. It employs 37,000 people nationwide who seed clouds by firing rockets and shells loaded with silver iodine into them. According to Zhang Qiang, head of the office, cloud seeding increased precipitation in Beijing by about one-eighth in 2004. Nationwide, similar effects added 7.4 trillion cubic feet of rain between 1995 and 2003. Weather modification technology is nothing new. It was deployed in the Vietnam War against the South Vietnamese to flood the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Could the Hawaii Corporation be responsible for the weather modification using chemtrails to intentionally cause a drought in order to secretly cut a sweetheart deal with Rick Perry, allowing the Chinese secret access to Beringer Hill's rare earth metals? With the drought coinciding with the Homeland Security lockdown of Buchanan Dam, I began to understand the whole thing. Because of the significantly lower water table of Lake Buchanan, this would make it much easier to access Beringer Hill for the purpose of mining rare earth metals. Would also be illegal due to EPA regulations, but if you could somehow force a closure of the dam under the guise of national security and then haul in the mining gear under the guise of quote-unquote dam refurbishments, you could conduct mining at Beringer Hill and no one would ever be the wiser. And from the looks of it, this is exactly what they did. I would have to make another trip back to collect any evidence. After retreating home feeling defeated from what I had learned about the Homeland Security takeover of the Buchanan Dam, Beringer Hill area, I came home and started researching more about the area to find out if there were any more sites like Beringer Hill. And to my surprise, Beringer Hill is just the tip of the iceberg for rare earth metals and other minerals that are abundant in the area. The two most abundant minerals that make up the Rockwall stones are zircon and garnet. Coincidentally, zircon and garnet happen to be two of the most abundant minerals found in the area around Lake Buchanan. After finding out that there was much more to explore and that Beringer Hill wasn't the end-all be-all, we loaded up again and hit the road. This time, not only to get more evidence of what is going on at Beringer Hill, but also to explore more of the geological sites around the area in central Texas. Once we arrived again at Lake Buchanan, I wasted no time in attempting to catch a glimpse of Beringer Hill, and once again the chemtrail planes were out in force, taking us from cold weather in Dallas to 90-plus degree temperatures at Lake Buchanan. Unfortunately, this is as close as we could get, but as you can see, it certainly is very interesting. You can clearly see what appears to be some kind of heavy construction equipment, cranes, trucks, and movers. And there it is, just near the dam, the tip-top of the 40-foot, now-submerged Beringer Hill. My hunch was correct, and there is definitely something going on over there, since there was no official reason given for the dam closing, and you can only find scant mention of it anywhere on the web. It became clear that Beringer Hill is slowly being exposed due to the ongoing drought, and the public is not wanted anywhere near it while it is. I had heard many stories of local residents dying from tumors and many different types of cancer in the area, presumably because of the high-level parts per million of radiation said to now be inundating the area due to the extreme drop of Lake Buchanan's water table. The aforementioned cavern near Beringer Hill, rumored to be the location where the uranium used in the Fat Man and Little Boy atomic experiments was mined, was not sealed because of a freak rainstorm that flooded the lake ahead of schedule. Since the water table has never dropped this low until recently, this has never been a problem. I saw a donation jar at a local burger joint raising money for a local cancer patient and heard at least four more stories of cancer cases just in the short time we were eating lunch. My desire to see Beringer Hill for myself stems strictly from wanting to see the supposed giant chunks taken out of it prior to mining being done there. But seeing a little of it for myself, along with the strong evidence to support a hidden agenda behind the closing of the Buchanan Dam by Homeland Security, was enough for me to know that I was on the right track. So we set out to explore more of this area known as the Llano Uplift. The Llano Uplift forms the hill country around Llano, Texas. Precambrian, igneous, and metamorphic rocks that are deeply buried under other rocks in the rest of Texas are exposed in the Llano Uplift. The uplift also exposes a rim of lower Paleozoic rocks that are typically hidden under the broad expanse of Cretaceous limestone in Texas. Since building stone, talc, serpentine, iron ore, copper, silver, and gold have been produced in the past, the area has become known as the Central Mineral Region. The Llano Uplift forms an island of granites, gneisses, and schists over 50 miles in width, which is surrounded by a sea of sedimentary rock. It turns out that there is some disagreement and uncertainty about just how long the uplift has been an uplift. You could say the why is because of the granites. The Llano Uplift is an uplift because the Earth's crust is thicker there than in the areas around the uplift. Specifically, the crust is both thick and composed of relatively light rocks at a depth. This thick, light crust floats high on the dense rocks of the Earth's mantle, bringing very old rocks up to the surface. The reason or reasons why the crust is thicker in the Llano Uplift is more difficult to explain. The crust can be thickened when tectonic plates collide and mountain ranges are formed, as in the Himalayas today. This may have played a part, but it is not clear why this would be localized where it is instead of being spread out along the continental margin. This unusual formation is a source of contention among some geologists, many of whom do not believe in the widely accepted uplift theory, because it is not spread out over a wide area, as it should always be if it is a true volcanic uplift. Many have speculated that it may have formed as a result of a massive impact that long ago slammed into the earth, bringing up many rocks and minerals, usually buried deep in the earth's crust to the top. Some of the local residents I talked to said they believe it was an asteroid that crashed here long ago, and judging by the things I saw, that may not be all that unlikely, as asteroids are known to be chock full of rare earth metals. Just like Rockwall and the Serpent Mound in Ohio, both of which are also explained as volcanic uplifts in location where there are no volcanic areas, which are always found near tectonic plates, the Llano uplift deserves further examination. The area around Llano is a cornucopia of minerals and rock. I have never before seen such a rich and diverse geological area before. I cannot believe I had ever been there or heard about it, seeing as it is only about 4 hours south of Dallas where I live. We came across so many rock samples and formations it was difficult to catalog or collect anywhere near the amount there were just scattered around everywhere you looked. Some of the rocks and minerals found in this area include granite, zircon, gadolinite, allanite, fergusonite, chlorophane, fluorite, pyrite, quartz, microcline feldspar, plagioclase, rutile, and hornblende are common constituents of granites and gneisses. Garnet, muscovite, biotite, starolite, and other metamorphic minerals occur in schists produced through the metamorphism of clay mineral-rich sediments. Tourmaline occurs in some schists in Llano County and in quartz veins in the Town Mountain Granite near Llano. Serpentine, an ultramafic rock composed of serpentine group minerals, occurs in the Coal Creek Igneous Complex. Another of the Llano uplift minerals is topaz, the Texas state mineral. Colorless to pale blue gemstone-quality topaz, crystallized from fluorine-rich gases, is found in the Llano uplift pegmatites. Coarse-grained crystals of smoky quartz, microcline, beryl, scheelite, and castorite also occur with topaz in the pegmatites. Another strange mineral found in the Llano uplift is llanite, named after the town of Llano, the only place on Earth where it is found. Geologists cannot explain how the blue quartz found in llanite was formed. To my astonishment, virtually every single material used in the rock wall stones is found in abundance here. And since the geopolymer mortar used between the stones was made of various different types of quartz crystals, this place was definitely capable of providing the large amounts of these materials that would have been needed in the casting of the rock wall stone. Next, we visited Enchanted Rocks and Jewelry in Llano to find out any information on other locations in the area where we might find more samples and outcroppings to film. The helpful folks there were able to inform us that most of the locations where these minerals are found are now strictly off limits behind private property for good reason. Nevertheless, I was able to purchase some samples of the local minerals and rare earths found in the Llano uplift, and they told us the location of an outcropping of llanite. I hope to return to Llano again for future volumes of this film series to visit and film some of the protected sites, which are granted access only to the privileged few. We were also advised to visit Enchanted Rock Park a few miles up the road. Enchanted Rock is an enormous pink granite pluton rock formation located in the Llano uplift approximately 15 miles north of Fredericksburg, Texas, and 15 miles south of Llano. Enchanted Rock State Natural Area, which includes Enchanted Rock and the surrounding land, spans the border between Gillespie County and Llano County, south of the Llano River. Enchanted Rock covers approximately 640 acres and rises approximately 425 feet above the surrounding terrain to an elevation of 1,825 feet above sea level. It is the largest such pink granite formation in the United States. Archaeological evidence indicates human visitation at the rock going back at least 11,000 years. Folklore of local Tonkawa, Apache, and Comanche tribes ascribe magical and spiritual powers to the rock. While attempting to hide from Anglo settlers in the area, the natives would hide on the top of two tiers of the rock where they were invisible from the ground below. The first European to visit the area was probably Alvar Nunez Cabeza de Vaca in 1536. The Tonkawa who inhabited the area in the 16th century believed that ghost fires flickered at the top of the dome. In particular, they heard unexplained creaking and groaning, which geologists attribute to the rock's nighttime contraction after being heated by the sun during the day. It was also revered by native tribes as a holy portal to other worlds and the possible location of the gold of El Dorado. Enchanted Rock is also said to be a hotbed of UFO activity. I was unable to determine if any astrological alignments have been found on Enchanted Rock, but its designation as a sacred site going back to just 1,000 years after the Great Flood was enough for me to check out this unbelievably huge and spiritual formation. The Llano Uplift is a fascinating place, and one could spend a lifetime just studying all the geology and mineralogy of this area. There is no question that it will play into our further investigations in the future, as I hope to obtain rock wall samples to have analyzed along with samples from the Llano Uplift to determine conclusively if the minerals found in the rock wall stones match those found in this area. Before heading home, I wanted to check out more of the area around Lake Buchanan to search for clues of possible evidence concerning ancient civilizations. I had heard about mounds in Fredericksburg right up the road, but found out these were on private property. This rock formation we found on a back row between Llano and Lake Buchanan looked identical to how the exposed stones of the rock wall found in front of the old rock wall courthouse look after having been exposed to the elements for years. And we found evidence that someone had long ago cut and stacked some of the rocks, some of which would be hard to move and stack even with today's machinery. This particular site is located a stone's throw away from Beringer Hill and caught my attention every time I visited the area. The rocks and stones were no doubt stacked here long ago, some of which were gigantic rocks stacked on top of each other. These had definitely been stacked there by someone, but from what the locals told me, they had always been there. After 3 trips to Central Texas, I was certain this was the quarry for the rock wall stones. But I would need further analysis of both rock wall and Llano uplift materials to know for sure. During the most recent excavation conducted at Rockwall in the late 1990s, Dr. Wolf Goss, a geologist from the University of Texas, conducted a paleomagnetic survey of the site. His findings scared him so much that he will not allow his paper on the subject to be published until after his death. According to John Lindsay, who hired Dr. Goss, he discovered that the wall had a magnetic field strength of 40 Gauss. How could these minerals exhibit a 40 Gauss field strength when the Earth's field as prime magnetizer averages 0.5 Gauss? The only rocks found to ever have this high of a magnetic field strength are found in asteroids and meteorites. I tested the magnetic field strength of some of the samples from the Llano uplift I collected and was getting consistent readings of 40 to 50 Gauss. But since this was measured using less than professional methods, further testing is needed with professional instruments before we can say for sure that the rocks from Llano have the same high Gauss magnetic field as that of the rock wall stones. Nevertheless, this would explain not only the origins of the stone's materials, but would also confirm the theory of a massive asteroid or comet slamming into and creating what is now the Llano uplift. Next, I was curious to know if any of the things I had researched earlier, such as giant skeletons, out-of-place artifacts, and rock wall-type structures, had been discovered in this area, and to my amazement, it seems that they have. In an April 23, 1893 article reprinted in the Los Angeles Times from the St. Louis Republic, according to the article, a massive, mostly buried wall was found near Milano, Texas, only 182 miles from Rockwall. The article stated, quote, "A Texas correspondent writes to one of the scientific departments of the government of a strangely interesting prehistoric wall discovered on the frontier of the Lone Star State. This marvelous ruin surpasses in interest all the other wonderful remains hereto found of the people who once inhabited the whole Mexican plateau and attained a high state of civilization. It passes through Milano and has a total length of about 20 miles. It is built of solid masonry, 10 to 15 feet high and as many feet thick. Its height and thickness are thus almost as great as the Chinese wall in the north of China. The direction is northeast to southwest. It is for the most part underground, and that is one of the curious things that puzzle those wise men who are supposed to know about prehistoric remains. It is undoubtedly very old." The writer goes on to suggest that the 20-mile-long wall might have been the gigantic foundations of a much larger structure, which had been eventually pulled down by invading enemies or by time. It is also mentioned in the 1893 article that a huge megalithic temple had also been found on a nearby hill which had been supported by 200 or more lofty pillars, some of which remained at that time. Inside the temple were, according to the article, many statues of idols, similar to the Baal worship we discussed earlier, all curiously marked, as well as the bones of large animals, many of them petrified, including reptiles. It was speculated that human and animal sacrifices took place at the temple. Returning to the wall, there was reported to have been an 8-foot section of it containing numerous inscriptions. Near the wall were found iron smelting furnaces. Once again, quoting from the article, an enormous amount of labor and materials must have been required for its construction if built above ground on the same gigantic plan as the foundation. Although there were toward 1 million people then living in that vicinity, the work must have extended over a considerable period of time. Curiously, there seems to be precious little additional information in the way of news or scientific items or photos available concerning the Milano Wall or the megalithic temple, even from the local historical society. If the wall was truly of the size and thickness reported, it surely must be a noticeable feature of the area. One would also have expected some follow-up from the archaeological community. Such seems to be the fate of certain archaeological anomalies. What choice do conventional archaeologists have than to, one, call it a natural feature, or two, claim that the Native Americans built it, or three, ignore it altogether? Even the Aztecs and the Incas, who had built few large edifices this far north, would have been hard-pressed to build a 20-mile-long, 10 to 15-foot-high and thick masonry wall, so who built it? I had no idea until after I had completed my expeditions in Llano that Milano, Texas, is only 2 hours east of Lake Buchanan and 1 hour east from Interstate 35. This was a game changer. Here we have a report of yet another 20-mile diameter wall with strange symbols and artifacts being found and evidence of metal smelting occurring at the site. It seems highly likely that this could have been the site where the materials were collected in the Llano uplift and then processed before being sent for use in the rock wall. Milano is a rural area and not as built upon as Rockwall is now, so I'm hoping we may be able to conduct an archaeological dig there in the future for more films in this series. The Sumerian King List, an ancient Mesopotamian clay tablet which is now in a museum in Oxford, England, details a 432,000-year pre-diluvial time period from the arrival of the gods on Earth and a 241,200-year reign of 10 pre-flood rulers in 6 cities. This matches the 10 pre-diluvial patriarchs found much later in biblical texts. 432,000 has been associated with divine duration in varied cultures well beyond the boundaries of Mesopotamia, including Indian and Hindu religions. The Greek mathematician Claudius Ptolemy used the number 432,000 as the totality of the great circle of the table of chords with which he calculated musical frequencies. In the poetic Edda, composed in Iceland between 800 and 1270 AD, it is said that at the end of the world, when the world shall dissolve into the sea, as it also does in the Xenophanes and the Hindu Vaisnava, 800 warriors will go out to the final battle through each of the 540 doors of Odin's palace. 800 times 540 equals 432,000. The number 432 is concealed repeatedly in the ratio system of the sacred architecture of Angkor Wat in Cambodia, and the traditional date for St. Patrick's mission to Ireland is 432 AD. With soil samples from Rockwall indicating a massive flood event 12,000 years ago, and dating falling consistently in the 200 to 400,000 year range for the Rockwall, combined with the coin found in Illinois with similar inscriptions to the Sanders Stone being found in the soil strata dating to 200,000 years, as well as the tile floor in Oklahoma having that same date range, it became quite clear that what we may be dealing with here in Rockwall is, in fact, one of these 6 pre-flood cities ruled over before the deluge. Since the entire rock wall is level at 550 feet above sea level, constructed of not rock or stone, but crystals and rare earth metals, with load bearings built to stand the test of time as well as piezoelectrical energy induced by sound frequencies, and was constructed in 3.5 feet of seawater where fresh sand dollars were preserved, the structure also contains the golden ratio or pi. This is why the modern Freemasons refer to Pythagoras as their great friend and brother, even though Freemasonry was not around in its present form until well after the time of Pythagoras. It seems that Rockwall is the strongest candidate yet to be one of these pre-flood Atlantean cities. And this would also explain why those who wish to keep a lid on the Rockwall are in many cases Freemasons themselves, to preserve the secrets of the order and to keep the false timelines propagated by both creationists and scientists confusing any serious investigation into these affairs.
At 32 feet I began to dig up a lot of sand dollars, Arachidea. Arachidea is their scientific name, but they're sand dollars you find on the beach. In doing so, and then we were getting into sandy loam through this blue shale. In doing so, finding them, I would crack them open, and there'd be fresh meat in there. Of course, this is damp soil going down and consistent temperatures. But what I saw immediately was this is not millions of years old. It's thousands, tens of thousands of years old, or they would have been petrified by then with the history of geology, the ups and downs and uplifts and cover-ups and everything. These should have been petrified to be a 2 million-year-old exposed wall of incalmed ancient oceans that receded. So that got my attention that, well, we're looking at something not millions of years old, but in the thousands-year-old range, which leads us, you know, to a dating aspect. Before we get into more refined dating in this geological time here, we'd like to make another note that I found in the dig, and that is in digging out, excavating the wall parallel with the wall out about 30 feet from it so we could turn the dozer around and get material out and control the water and so forth from rains. I dug a cross section up to the wall about 30 feet wide, and it got wider than that as we went, removing the overburden. And that's where it stood out at me. Soil composition, rock wall, first few feet down to 15, typical 15 to 20 feet. When we lay foundation, we dig pier holes for buildings, and the average is about 16 feet on a pier hole, getting us into the blue shale, which is stable, solid material to set foundations on. Above that is what's known as the caliche, which is a white clay, and it has a real expansive nature to it. And what we did with this caliche, we got a large test tube and filled it full of the caliche. It had been dried, sifted in there, and started dropping water in it, drops, and let it saturate. And when it got to full saturation, the 2 inches of soil we had in there rose to 7 inches. So that's how expansive this soil material is that's above the blue shale. And that's why all the buildings in rock wall require us to get through it or either use post-tension slabs and float on it, because it's some of the most horrible soil conditions in the country because of its expansive nature when it gets wet. So getting through that and looking back at the profile, the cross-section of the wall, I saw the caliche and the blue shale. And coming out from the wall, they were steeply spiked, maybe 25, 30 feet spikes, a blue shale going almost to the surface, or caliche clay going down. And as you got out from the wall, these peaks began to widen out. So what it did show me, and I got other scientists looking at the mechanisms to agree with me, is that the cover-up of this wall of the overburden was done in a catastrophic event. It was slammed, pushed up against the wall. And here's the evidence of that. It was not sedimentary that just slowly oceans receded and left it covered. It was a catastrophic event. Well, then that brings us back to the question, well, when and how was the wall covered? In looking back at history, geological history and scientific history, we know of the events on Earth, either through meteorite impacts, different calamities happened in the world going back. There was an event about 12,000 years ago that caused worldwide flooding. And before that, I think 18,000 years ago, and then there has been several events. But the most recent one would be about 12,000 years ago, this deluge. And we have a perfect mechanism set up by our location for this to happen, because we're on the Trinity River. We have this plateau. So imagine this wall stood up there, and from the bottom of the river, which I know the river because I knew the land before it was covered with the lake, the elevation from the bottom of the river out to the Gulf is less than 1% slope, and that continues all the way down through the Trinity Valley down to the Gulf. So if you had a mechanism of something hit in the Gulf, push all this overburden, i.e. the blue shale, with all its sand dollars and all the other seashells and stuff we see mixed in with this, which is only contingent with this blue shale. And covering this wall, we have an event out there that can easily push up here and hit the wall and cover it because of the slope of its location and slope to the Gulf of Mexico. It's my opinion that what we're covered with is overburden from ocean floor out in the Gulf, which is the blue shale, which is the same material that's there. Now, later on, we found satellite photographs that traces the recession of this water back to the Gulf and leaves pooling of blue shale. And we get this from geological maps all the way down from Rockwall, all the way down the Trinity to Huntsville, and on down to the ocean poolings of low areas where this blue shale settles. So there was an event that pushed this ocean material up over us and then receded. It's not natural to the area because you get across the Trinity River and other areas of Texas, you dig down, you don't get this same geological column that we have here. What I'm saying is it had to be built before the flood because it was covered up. Now, how do I know it was open before that? Well, we found shark's teeth in the wall. In the 40s, one of the judges there, I found newspaper clippings. They were finding shark's teeth lodged in the joints of the wall back then. So we know the ocean was up there one time. It's just a matter of when. So when you have a calamity like this to push this up, then yes, you're gonna find that profile and you're gonna find shark's teeth and everything else gathered up to the wall. Because of the sand dollars, because of the shark's teeth in the wall, and because of some dating, I believe the wall was actually a seawall that supported a plateau between the Trinity River, which is about 90 feet below us in real life, if you take the water away. Well, this is a deep canyon. We used to hunt squirrels off the banks of the canyon on the top of these 100-foot oak trees down there when we were kids. And on the back side or the east side of the wall, as we found in satellite evidence, there's ancient mountain range. So in between the river and the ancient mountain range, and you can still see evidence of that from space when you see low sunsets and the curvatures. And actually this ridge, this mountain range, begins, and the pinnacle of it is there in Rockwall, which would come out into the ancient seas there, comes back up and goes north of Denton, turns and pretty much follows 114 out here to Lubbock and ends up on up on the Cap Rock here. And at first when I saw this, I said, wow, that's a natural for Indians to herd the buffalo in, come down, trap them off, and have food supply down here. But it turned out to be much, much before then. But anyway, that's what it says here is this wall is situated on a unique geological plateau here.
Shortly after the release of Lost Secrets Volume 1, it was announced that the History Channel would be filming an episode of its America Unearthed with Scott Walter program in Rockwall, to be aired sometime in late 2013. It was announced that they would excavate and film a section of the wall for the program, and that it would be the end-all, be-all investigation into the rock wall. The best part? History Channel claimed it would do all of that in just 1 week. Immediately, red flags began to come up for me because of the months and months of digging described to me by John Lindsay and the arduous task of breaking through layers of blue shale before reaching the wall at all. Somehow, the History Channel was going to have a way around all that, it seemed. A few months later, more information about the situation appeared in the Rockwall newspaper, claiming that they had special advanced equipment donated by the Hyundai Corporation that would speed up the digging in ways not possible in the last dig, which began in 1999. Sounds plausible, right? The problem is, however, as these pictures show, there doesn't seem to be anything advanced about this equipment. And several experts I showed these pictures to said absolutely this equipment existed in the late 1990s and even before. This is all made null and void, however, by the fact that they go on to admit in the article that the so-called dig being conducted by the History Channel is actually nothing of the sorts. They simply pulled the reburied soil off the previous 1999 dig site and claimed that this was some kind of new excavation. This makes the claim of advanced digging equipment even more ridiculous because no advanced equipment is even needed to remove the soil from the location where the long task of breaking through the blue shale has already been accomplished. When America Unearthed first aired in late 2012, viewers were asked to submit sites for the show to investigate in future episodes. I have been contacted by two different individuals, one of whom is the granddaughter of Dr. James Glenn of Rockwall, who we discussed in Volume 1.
In both cases, the History Channel did not seem interested in their information about the rock wall until after The Lost Secrets of Ancient America, Volume 1, was released. It became quite clear that a top-down funded whitewash of the rock wall was being planned by the History Channel as a response to the explosive revelations discussed in Volume 1. There have been no mainstream scientific or media outlets interested in covering the rock wall whatsoever until now. But within months of releasing the first film ever made about the rock wall, all of a sudden it warrants a $1 million TV show? Host of America Unearthed, Scott Walter, said in the Rockwall newspaper article that he had never heard of the wall till viewers made them aware of it. Yet the person given credit for getting the History Channel to Rockwall is not one of the two individuals who tried for months to get History Channel to look at their Rockwall info with no response. The credibility of the so-called investigations conducted by America Unearthed rides solely on the shoulders of its host, Scott Walter. The opening of each episode of America Unearthed has Walter claiming he is a forensic geologist to try and lend an air of credibility to the conclusions in which Mr. Walter attempts to sell to the viewers. His credibility first came into question after researchers started to look closer into Walter's supposed honorary master's degree from the University of Minnesota. This honorary degree, which Walter claimed on his resume was obtained in 1987, does not exist in the record of the University of Minnesota. The reason it does not exist in their records is because the school has not issued any honorary degrees since 1956, making it impossible for Mr. Walter to have obtained an honorary degree there in 1987. Walter has since removed this degree from his resume and website, but it remains to be seen if the intro to America Unearthed will be altered as well. In the aforementioned Rockwall newspaper article, Walter claims he had never heard of the Rockwall, yet in a book published in March of 2012, Scott Walter contributes several chapters, but somehow misses the Rockwall information sandwiched right next to his own writing. Did Walter just miss this info because getting his work published isn't a big thing to him anymore? Maybe so. But in his online explanation of his honorary degree that doesn't exist, Mr. Walter explains very clearly that getting his work published is a priority, and that this degree was given to him to cheer him up after the death of his father in a diving accident Walter claims was his fault. If Mr. Walter trusted the author of this book, Frank Joseph, so much as to not even bother to read the other material which would be included inside the book with his own, then it speaks volumes not only for Walter's lack of interest in the credibility of his own work, but also of his seeming uninterest in collaborating on this book with a well-known neo-Nazi and convicted child molester. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Joseph, a.k.a. Frank Collin, who was born Francis Joseph Cohen on November 3, 1944, formerly served as the leader of the National Socialist Party of America. In the late 1970s, while president of the NSPA, Frank Collin was arrested by Michigan police while having sex with a pair of 10-year-old boys. These revelations led to his dismissal from the neo-Nazi movement. A psychiatrist who interviewed Collin declared that he was consumed by hatred for his father. It was argued that Collin rejected his father by becoming a neo-Nazi and adopting and publicly espousing anti-Semitic beliefs. Collin was convicted of child molestation and sent to Pontiac Correctional Center in 1979, where he served only 3 years of a 7-year sentence. The History Channel seems to have no problem with Walter's association with Frank Joseph either. Yet we know they are quite aware of who he is, as their TV special, Nazi America, A Secret History, includes extensive footage of Frank Collin and his neo-Nazi exploits. Once you look into who owns the History Channel and its affiliated H2 network on which America Unearthed airs, the whole picture becomes crystal clear. History and H2 are a joint venture between the Hearst Corporation and the Disney ABC Television Group division of the Walt Disney Company. As we discussed in Volume 1, many groups have a vested interest in these topics for a variety of reasons, including the Freemasons, neo-Nazis, and white supremacist groups. The Hearst Corporation, one of the biggest media conglomerates in the world, worth an estimated $9 billion, is steeped in Freemasonic heritage going back to the founding of Hearst Publishing by William Randolph Hearst, and continuing today with the current chairman, William Randolph Hearst III. Its major interests include 15 daily and 36 weekly newspapers, and more than 300 magazines worldwide, including Harper's Bazaar, Cosmopolitan, Esquire, Elle, O, The Oprah Magazine, 29 television stations through Hearst Television Incorporated, which reach a combined 18% of U.S. viewers, ownership in leading cable networks, including the A&E networks and ESPN. William Randolph Hearst upset the left wing in America by being a pro-Nazi in the 1930s and a staunch anti-communist in the 1940s. One of the favorite tactics employed by the History Channel is sensationalism, using well-produced commercials and keyword taglines to rope viewers into watching programs with little to no educational or historical value in order to sell big-ticket advertising. This is a technique known as yellow journalism, and it was invented by, you guessed it, William Randolph Hearst and Hearst Publishing. Let's look at how yellow journalism is defined and see if it fits into what we see from the History Channel. Yellow journalism, or the yellow press, is a type of journalism that presents little or no legitimate, well-researched news and instead uses eye-catching headlines to sell more newspapers. Techniques may include exaggerations of news events, scandal-mongering, or sensationalism. By extension, the term yellow journalism is used today as a pejorative to decry any journalism that treats news in an unprofessional or unethical fashion. Frank Luther Mott defines yellow journalism in terms of five characteristics: scare headlines in huge print, often of minor news; lavish use of pictures or imaginary drawings; use of faked interviews, misleading headlines, pseudoscience, and a parade of false learning from so-called experts. The Hearst Corporation is using the same tactics it invented for print media over 100 years ago in the modern media, television. They trick the public into believing they offer truth, then bombard them with commercials, leaving them with more questions than answers at the end of the show. Would you take any information you read in a magazine from a supermarket checkout stand as the end-all, be-all, final word on anything? Then why would you take it from the History Channel networks, which are the modern-day equivalent? This is exemplified in History Network's use of Eric von Daniken, writer for the tabloid rag The Weekly World News, and his disciple Giorgio Tsoukalos. As I stated earlier, History Networks are also co-owned by the Walt Disney Corporation, a company with Freemasonic connections and alleged Nazi ties. Disney has shown its Freemasonic cards many times, from their 33rd Degree Club to their National Treasure disinfo films. When you combine all that with Walter's obsession with attempting to tie almost everything found in ancient America to the Knights Templar, and consider that the Freemasons were formed after the dissolution of the Templars, it becomes quite apparent that Scott Walter and America Unearthed are a disinformation vehicle for high-level Masonic interests that wish to keep these secrets from the public and keep the real truth of America's history quietly buried under human progress. Don't forget that Texas Congressman Ralph Hall from Rockwall also attended the History Channel's so-called dig. Hall, who is also a Freemason, is rumored to be in possession of the Sanders Stone, which we discussed in Volume 1. Clearly, the History Network's attempts to own and control the Rockwall investigation is a response to the information contained in the Lost Secrets of Ancient America, Volume 1.
It says right here in black and white in the geological report on the Rockwall, the main contention from the History Channel was that the paleomagnetic data said that it was a natural formation based on the magnetic signature going in a uniform area. But what they did not include was, as I stated in the film, the mineral composition of the wall. And that is where the problem lies. If you do not name or state what the mineral composition of the wall is to the person who is doing the paleomagnetic survey, they are going to get incorrect results. And this is absolute proof that the History Channel is lying with their conclusion that the wall is a natural formation, because it says in black and white right here, ladies and gentlemen, that because these wall stones contain so much quartz, quartz actually gives a magnetic signature that goes in a uniform fashion. Let's read this. It says, the author proposes that the presence of earlier crystallization, elevated spotted orientated concentration of magnetic mineral crystalline silt grains and associated remnants is proof of the material's igneous origins and later calcite matrix crystallization. Now, he's still coming from the standpoint that this is somehow natural. But listen, just pay attention to this. He's talking about the paleomagnetic data. He says this is in keeping with paleomagnetic igneous material crystallization and orientation with the Earth's dipole magnetic field. Once Curie point is reached, for each of the respective magnetic grains, the difference noted in this case is the randomness of the fields within the bulk material. Now, right there, he says, the randomness of the magnetic field within this material. Now, the History Channel stated that if it was random, then it would have to be a man-made creation, or creation made by someone, maybe not necessarily man, but by somebody. But that was their whole basis. Now, let's keep going here. Now, it says right there, note, he says right there that the magnetic field in the rock wall is random. The concentration of magnetic grains within the bulk material is higher than locally sourced sandstones and could conceivably achieve or supply, as is the occasional remnant's hotspot orientations. The molecular domains, the local deeper stratigraphy position sandstones are chiefly non-magnetic. This is a direct analogy to a typical magnetic material prior to magnetization. The molecular domains are chiefly random. There it is again, random, not uniform, as the History Channel state. When subjected to a low magnetizing force, some of the molecular domains align while others do not, thus creating hot spots within the magnetic material, which is exactly what we are seeing in this case. Only at a grain size level instead of a molecular level. Within the bulk stone material, we have a mineral grain that have high magnetic susceptibilities, each of which displays domain alignment at a molecular level within each grain. Now, he goes on down here to say that the minerals within the dike stone align with each other and not the earth's field due to their stronger field strength. However, the mineral silt grain fraction of the bulk stone is chiefly composed of quartz. A diamagnetic material see where I left off. I'm sorry. Had to switch arms there. That arm was getting tired. Let me go back. He says, the bulk stone is chiefly composed of quartz, a diamagnetic material that cannot display remnants. The grain encapsulating calcite is also diamagnetic. Most of the magnetic grains were mechanically held apart from one another by the other mineral grain fraction, hence only where localized density separations concentrated the grains within the stone, we do find grain alignment and hot spots. So he says right there that because the majority of the wall is made of chiefly quartz, quartz is a diamagnetic material that cannot display remnants, meaning it cannot display a magnetic signature. So because of that, and because they didn't bother to tell anyone what the wall was made of, they just went and tested some rocks that could have been from anywhere that they claimed were limestone, didn't bother doing any tests on the wall that they dug up. They instead did it on some rocks that supposedly came from the 76 dig. But we see here from the geology report, it is absolute bunkum, folks. Right there, composed of quartz, a diamagnetic magnetic material that cannot display remnants. Because quartz in any stone like that is going to have a uniform magnetic signature. But because they didn't bother to tell anyone it was quartz, they can tell anybody anything they want as far as the results of that paleomagnetic survey. And that's it right there, folks, in a nutshell.
A couple of months ago, I was intrigued about something going on in North Texas called the Rock Wall. So I started looking at some things happening at U of H with some of the professors in the archaeology. Oh, God, am I supposed to smile? In the archaeology and the astronomy and all that stuff out there, and that they were talking about new technology that they were using in South America. And they were finding things that they could not see from the air before. Consequently, they contacted someone in Rockwall, and they mentioned Rockwall. And I said, well, gosh, that's Texas. I'm going to check that out. I started looking for the rock wall in Rockwall, Texas. And guess who popped up? A gentleman named Josh Reeves. I called him. Actually, I emailed him. We chatted a little bit. He agreed to come to Houston and to address us this afternoon. And since we're running so late, I'm not going to talk anymore. I promise. I'm just going to say, welcome, Josh Reeves, to Houston, Texas.
Thank you, Johnny. How's everybody doing today?
Good.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. I want to thank Paranormal Planet, Houston, everybody, for having me out today. I'm going to talk about my little notes here, so I have to make sure I have my outline all set. But I want to talk first about how I got into all this and how I got into finding out about the rock wall and actually get into my whole history of how I got into research and all that altogether, because it's very, very interesting and important to the story. When I started out researching, everybody always asks, when did you start researching all this? And they kind of laugh at me because the fact of the matter is I started researching this when I was in the third grade. I started researching UFOs, Bermuda Triangle stuff. Later when I got into high school, I was researching JFK and the Kennedy assassination and all sorts of conspiracies and stuff after that. And I, as an adult, just researched more and more and got into all these different topics. And growing up, I had a lot of different experiences that were really unexplained. Has anybody here ever had what they would call a paranormal experience or a UFO sighting or anything? Anybody? Anybody?
Oh, yeah.
Just about everybody here?
Yeah.
Okay. So you understand that. Well, that was my thing. Is growing up, I grew up in Dallas and really around the suburbs. Rockwall is about 30 miles east of Dallas. And I grew up in a little town that was about 20 or 30 miles east, farther east where Rockwall is. But I spent a lot of time around Rockwall as a kid. And I can remember when I was about 5 or 6, my grandparents used to have speedboats, and they used to take speedboats out on Lake Ray Hubbard, which is where part of the rock wall is now submerged underneath the lake. And I remember being out on these speedboats with my grandfather, about 5 or 6, and I remember my grandfather saying, Josh, did you know when they built this lake, they didn't allow the construction workers to get their construction equipment, their diggers out of the lake before they filled up with water. They had to leave them down there, and it stayed down there to this day. And I don't know what made me remember that, but I'll tell you why it's important in a bit. And then fast forward into my teenage years, I had a missing time event real close to the rock wall. A friend and I were going to work in Dallas. We left at noon, and when we got across the bridge, it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were just scared and confused and didn't know what was going on, so I called. We called home. We said, what time did we leave for work today? And they were like, are you crazy? Are you on drugs? You left at, 12 o'clock. And we were like, oh, what's going on with this? This is very strange. And then we had a couple of friends talk about the same thing. And then a few years later, we were out near the lake, and we were out just kind of hanging out late one night. And a friend of and I got hit. It's the only way I can describe it, by some force, some energy force, that literally knocked us out, made us black out, and really made us cry and emotional, and it just stuck with us. And we always wondered, if there was some sort of connection, because it always seemed to happen in and around the area of Rock Wall. And another incident, when me and the same friend were about 16 years old, we were in Greenville, Texas, which is about 30 miles east of Rock Wall, and we saw a UFO that was heading towards Dallas, and we just got in the truck and just hauled and started following this thing. And we're following this thing and following this thing. And right when it gets to that same area of rock wall where the bridge is, we see this beam just shoot up like this and then shoot back across the sky. And it was always something that really, what caused that? Well, in 2004, I was reading Jamar's book, Rule by Secrecy. And I got to the end of a chapter, and there's a chapter in there where he says, maybe one day we'll have answers to all the questions that we see, such and such, this, that, and the other, in the ancient, mysterious rock wall in Rockwall, Texas. And I said, wow. Wait a minute, what's this? This has got to be something connected to that. So immediately, as soon as I heard about it, even though I had no facts and I had no information to back up anything about it yet, I said, I just knew in my gut, this is connected to it, and I'm going to uncover this. And fast forward a few more years, 2007, I made my first film. It was on 9/11. It was called 9/11 New World Rising. And I started doing my radio show then, and after I started doing my radio show, I had every intention of wanting to make this Rockwall film and doing the Rockwall research, but I just wasn't there yet. So I started doing other films and other topics. And then about a year later, after starting my radio show, I met with some friends who I had told about the Rockwall, and they were very interested in it. They kind of took the ball and ran with it and set up this meeting with a guy named John Lindsay, who was one of the guys who did an archaeological dig at the site, part of the Rockwall, in 1999 and 2000. So I went to his house, met with him, and we spent about 2 hours at his house. He's talking to us, explaining. I'll talk more about him here in just a minute. But the Rockwall, this is actually a little effigy of the Rockwall. It sits out of the side of the Rockwall Courthouse, the old Rockwall Courthouse in Rockwall. This was erected in 1976 for the state sesquicentennial of Texas, or bicentennial of Texas, and they had a excavation at the Rockwall dig during that time as well. What they did was they took a bunch of these stones and they just, you see the stuff in between the rocks there. That's not the same mortar substance that we'll talk about here in a bit that was found in between the stones. But they took these stones and they just kind of threw them up there. And this is actually the only place where you can go now and see anything related to Rockwall. The biggest question I always get concerning the Rockwall is, where can I go and see? Where can I go and visit this thing? And the fact of the matter is you can't, because it's buried, of course, and we'll talk more about that here in just a second. So I just, at a very early age, felt like there was something big I was going to do in my life. I don't know what possessed me to think that. And then when I found out this little thing was erected 2 days before I was born, I was like, okay, well, that's it. But this guy right here is John Lindsay. And this is a picture from the 99-2000 excavation. When I met with John, he's an architect. He no longer lives in Rockwall. He was actually, ran out of town, for lack of a better description. He was ran out of town by locals because he discovered that a high-level Texas congressman had a 2.5-ton garnet stone with hieroglyphs, strange hieroglyphs. We'll show you pictures and talk about that more later in the presentation. And when he started asking around about it, they ran him out of town, and he's now basically in seclusion and in hiding out in West Texas. I hope to be able to interview him later for Volume 2 of the film. But when I met with him at his house, he spent about 2 hours telling us about the Rockwall and talking about it. He was sort of building it up. It was quite hilarious because we were already of the impression when we met with him that this was somehow connected to extraterrestrial or somehow connected to something. And he spent 2 hours trying to lead up to saying, okay, I think this is built by aliens or something. And I think he thought we weren't going to be on board with that. It was quite funny. And at the end, we said, you know what, you can just spill it. We're all quite on board with this here. But he had a lot of the examples of some of the materials that were found and some of the artifacts that were found. We have to see. We'll talk about that here in just a few minutes. We can see this. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the history of the wall itself. This is the town of Rockwall here, and that in the middle is the old courthouse. Now, it was built on top of what has been described as a dome rock line temple wall. And this is where the courthouse is in. This is where they built the original courthouse where they put the little effigy at. And back in the 40s, some guys went and did some exploring underneath there, and supposedly they found all kinds of jewels and gold and all sorts of things, but there were some sort of structural issues, so they never went back in there. And this, of course, is where the 2.5-ton garnet stone that was found near Rockwall was restored until it was severely whisked away in the night by a high-level, well-known Texas congressman. We'll talk more about that later. But the Rockwall was discovered in 1852. This is the oldest known photograph of the Rockwall. This was taken sometime very early in the advent of photography. This is one of the first views and pictures of it that were ever seen when the town of Rockwall was first set up in the late 1800s. You had two gentlemen that came from, one that came from Virginia, one that came from Tennessee. It's very odd, both of these men were Freemasons, and there's really no indication as to why they decided to come to Rockwall, or what was so special about it that made them come and decide there. It seems to me, even though I can't prove this, that these gentlemen had some sort of advanced knowledge of what was there. So they come to Rockwall, they start getting the town set up. As of this point, the town doesn't have a name yet at all. It's just not called anything. About a year later or so, you started to have farming communities being set up. And when the farming communities started to get set up, you had all these different farmers that were coming in. They were all arguing over who wanted to, who got naming rights of the town. This guy wanted to name it Johnsonville. This guy wanted to name it Wadeville. They were arguing and bickering over who was going to get naming rights of the town. As soon as they started trying to set up water wells and began digging for water, they started noticing peculiarly that all of them began to hit some kind of stone or rock when they would go down and dig these water wells. Now, geologically, there is no rock, no natural rock found in this area of North Texas at all whatsoever, zero. So it was very anomalous when they started finding these, what looked like masonry walls, when they were trying to build their water wells. So they went into town, they got the two gentlemen, the Freemasons, that set up the town, and they said, you know, can you come look at this? We don't know what this is. We need you to come examine it. So the two gentlemen came out. They walked right up to this exact spot here. They looked at it, and they said, boys, you know, you guys, none of you can name this after yourselves, because this proves beyond any shadow of doubt that there were people here before us. And this is where the real genesis of the idea of this not being a natural formation first came into play. The town itself is situated right directly on top of this wall. The wall is 20 miles in diameter, but the it's 4 miles thick and 6 miles wide exactly on both sides. This was found on T. U. Wade's property. Mr. Wade was one of the original farmers that I mentioned that set up the town. He ended up utilizing this, obviously, as his water well, but the original intent of this was some sort of, they call this the watchtower. You can see it has some sort of window cut out in it. It has, this is the only known photograph, as far as I know, that there is of this. Many of the photographs I'm showing you, they came from the original dig, and also came from archives and whatnot. But this structure supposedly goes down, I don't know how, I mean, I'm sure it goes down the full length of the wall, which is roughly about 100 feet down to the bedrock. And supposedly this site, I'm hoping to be able to go get to see this site eventually because it's still there. And John Lindsay told me at one time that he knows where it's at and has gotten permission to go there. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to do that eventually. This is what they call the arch. This arch was found on the site of the original Wade farm where that well was already found. It has some sort of strange skull or emblem. We don't know quite sure what that is yet. This property that this is located on, I've been there, but I haven't been able to see it in any of the wall because it's buried underneath. And every time anyone's ever excavated any of this stuff, going back to the 1940s, the State of Texas Historical Society always shows up and says, cover it up, cover it back up, structural danger, and they never really have a solid reason as to why, other than structural danger. And it's the same story that they've given every time there's been any sort of new archaeological digs. This is the same story that they give. So this is still there, and this is still in existence. This were at the same location. They had back in the 1940s, they had this little display set up, and you could, of course, go and pay. I don't quite know what the difference is between the admission. They had a 15-cent admission and a 25-cent admission. I don't know whether you got to see deeper for 25 cents. I'm not really sure. But this is, the state of Texas actually eventually shut this down because they did not like the fact that the guy was, Mr. Boydson, who was doing this, was telling the people that this was the remnant of an ancient civilization. They had a big, big problem with that because obviously that's something they didn't want people to know. And
All right, folks, there you go. That's virtually everything I have on the rock wall, and a lot of people have requested that I make this standalone film separate from the Lost Secrets of Ancient America films with just the rock wall stuff in it. And the question I always get the most is, are you ever going to have a dig? Well, you know, that's not up to me, man. I mean, a lot of things have to happen in order for us to be able to have a dig. We have to have a piece of property to dig on. We have to for sure know the rock wall's on that piece of property, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I'm hopeful that maybe one day it might happen, but I also don't have very high hopes either, because I've attempted to get this thing off the ground and get a dig going, but you know, it's really going to take somebody, hopefully maybe somebody seeing this even. It's going to take somebody coming forward and going, okay, I want to do this, I'll put the money up, I'll buy the piece of property. I mean, that's really all we need. If we can get a piece of property that has part of the rock wall on it, or we can find somebody willing to let us dig on it, I can get all the rest. I mean, I got guys that are willing to donate, you know, earth movers and all that stuff to do it. We just don't have a dig site, and we've been unable to find one up until this point. So anybody out there, if you want to help and try and get a dig going, contact me. I'll put my contact email and all that at the end of this film. And, you know, I'm still wanting to do it and document it all and document all those things that John Lindsay and others witnessed during previous digs that they did not document. So, yeah, I mean, I still want to do it. We'll see. I don't know. Maybe it'll happen one day. Maybe it won't. But if you have the means to help make a dig happen, definitely get in contact with me, okay? Thanks for watching. That's the Rock Wall.